written, "Behaviors that would be ordinary or even exemplary for gender-conforming boys and girls are presented as symptomatic of mental disorder for gender non-conforming children," meaning that what is deemed healthy in a girl is considered a symptom of psychiatric illness in a boy. Activists have spoken of the GID diagnosis being used not only to prevent natal boys from identifying as girls and natal girls from identifying as boys, but also to stigmatize or prevent effeminate homosexuality and butch lesbianism. Stephanie Brill added, "A male child who says, 'I must be a girl because only girls want to do these things,' is not showing evidence of being transgender. He's showing evidence of sexism." Gerald Mallon and Teresa DeCrescenzo, social workers with experience in this community, complain that natal boys are given the sports corrective and natal girls the etiquette corrective. At the 2009 meeting of the American Psychiatric Association, protesters gathered at a Reform GID Now demonstration. Diane Ehrensaft of the Child and Adolescent Gender Center in Berkeley, California, where she specializes in children with gender identity issues, said, "The mental health profession has been consistently doing harm to children who are not gender normal, and they need to retrain." Other activists, however, rail against the possibility of losing the diagnostic category. In The Riddle of Gender, Deborah Rudisill writes, "The diagnosis legitimizes the range of hormonal and surgical interventions that have provided relief to thousands of transsexual and transgendered people. Activists who argue that the medical model of gender variance pathologizes human diversity tend to miss this point. Without some sort of diagnosis, sex reassignment becomes nothing more than a kind of extreme cosmetic surgery, body enhancement, or in the view of critics, a fad, a fashion, a craze." GID's presence in the DSM facilitates insurance coverage for the psychological support transgender people may require. William Narrow, the research director for the DSM-5, has said, "The harm of retention is stigma, and the harm of removal is potential loss of access to care." "The task at hand," he continued, "is to create a situation where access can be not only available but increased, and discrimination can be reduced." This quandary echoes the experience of deaf people and dwarfs who may not care for the disability label, yet need it to secure accommodations and services. Surgical and endocrine interventions for transgender people, however, are seldom eligible for reimbursement and tax deductibility. Many transgender people would like to see their condition classified as a physical condition, which would resolve that problem. Michelle Angelo, a PhD therapist specializing in gender identity issues, has pointed out that if something can be fixed with a physical transformation, it shouldn't be categorized as a mental health condition. Some activists maintain that trans, like pregnancy, is a medical condition but not a disease. The AMA has issued a resolution that they support health insurance coverage for treatment of gender identity disorder as recommended by a physician, which leaves the door open for bodily or psychological interventions. Reclassification as an endocrine or neurocognitive condition could be achieved by developing a new listing in the ICD, the International Statistical Classification of Diseases, of the World Health Organization. As long as GID is classed as a mental illness, professionals will try to cure it, and parents will refuse to accept it. It is time to focus on the child rather than on the label. Edgardo Menvier, a psychiatrist at Children's National Medical Center, said, "The goal is for the child to be well-adjusted, healthy, and have good self-esteem. What's not important is molding their gender." it seems right to prioritize each child's mental health over a system that makes universal predictions about what should constitute happiness or what values are healthy. Menvier does not see trans children as being automatically disordered. He does see them as being at risk. Peggy Cohen-Ketanis, a professor of gender development who works in Amsterdam, has likewise attempted to diagnose and treat functional problems, such as separation anxiety, disorganized parenting, and depression. So regardless of which gender the child ultimately exhibits, the family is well. In other words, gender identity should not obscure underlying problems, and such problems should not interfere with addressing gender identity. Most deaf people don't take exception to being called deaf. Most people with intellectual disabilities raise no objection to the term Down syndrome. Yet gender identity disorder infuriates the people it ostensibly describes to a degree and extent that transcends semantics. Most conditions in this book entail a positive model of identity and a negative model of disorder. While no one wants to be put in a stigmatized diagnostic category, most people fight the stigma rather than the category. Those who think of deafness or autism as identities can do so even if others call them disorders. GID suggests not simply that trans people have a disorder, but that their identity itself is the disorder. This is a dangerous standpoint. We all have multiple identities, and most of us regret some of them. But identity is who we are. The law of identity is among the first precepts of philosophy. It states that everything is the same as itself. Aristotle explained that the single cause as to why the man is a man or the musician musical is simply because each thing is inseparable from itself. Locke declares that our most fundamental knowledge is a man is a man. Undermining anyone's personal tautology by suggesting that he should not in fact be himself sabotages whatever he might become. The GID designation bespeaks an agenda of terminating identity. You can seek better ways to manifest identity, but you can't ask any class of people to discard their identity itself. The 20th century reached its nadir with attempts to free the world of Jewish identity, Tutsi identity, or the many identities that communism suppressed. The practice of obliterating identities does not work at this macro level. It does not work well at the micro level either. Bettina and Greg Verdi both come from traditional Italian Catholic families in the Northeast. Greg works as an airline ground mechanic and Bettina as a preschool teacher. When Greg was hired by Lockheed Martin, they moved south of Atlanta. Their second child, Paul, preferred pink toys at 3 months. At 2, he would drape a shirt over his head to mimic long hair and wear one of Bettina's tank tops as a gown. When he was 2.5, Bettina agreed to get him a yellow flowered dress at a garage sale. "I figured at home at playtime, what's the harm?" Bettina said. Greg was not entirely comfortable with the dress, but like Bettina, he assumed it was a phase. When their older son, Eric, was 4, his preschool had a visiting day for siblings, and Bettina took Paul. Families were coming in with girls in frilly dresses, and Paul gasps, "Mom, I want that dress," Bettina recalled. All the moms were giggling. Bettina told her pediatrician that Paul headed for the girls' section at every toy store. The doctor said, "Well then, say no." Greg said, "Paul would say, if I can't have the girl toys, then let's get out of the toy store." At 5, Paul said to Bettina, "Mom, I want to go to school as a girl, dress like a girl, have a girl name, have girl toys. I want to be a girl. Bettina was terrified. They went back to their pediatrician and asked what he thought about GID. He told them those children mostly committed suicide, so they should go to the Christian bookstore, read up on it, and pray. Bettina found a therapist in Atlanta and made an appointment to go in with Greg. I was prepared to make this happen without Greg, Bettina said. But on the drive home, Greg said to Bettina, okay, let's do it. Bettina called a good friend whose kids were the same age as hers and suggested a playdate. I told her, we want you to call her Paula. She said, oh, Bettina, I don't know. The kids are going to make fun of him. I said, can we try it? So they went. The older son said to Eric, how come your brother is dressed like a girl? Eric said, it's called transgender. It means when a boy wants to be a girl or a girl wants to be a boy. I don't really want to talk about it. The boy said, okay, let's go play. The younger one never even noticed, probably because Paul had always acted like a girl. Bettina went to see the religious education director at her Catholic church. I was so emotional about it. She was like, okay, do you want her to attend as Paula? We'll just change the paperwork. So we transitioned to church. Next, Bettina told the school, and the principal said, we provide a safe, friendly environment for all our children, and yours is no different. Paula would have to use the nurse's bathroom, but otherwise she would just be Paula. Bettina's family was supportive from the start. Greg's parents, already in their 80s, accepted it the first time they saw Paula. But Greg and Bettina did not reckon with their community. Suddenly, we're in the Bible Belt, Greg said. Bettina notified the neighbors. I had gone to the bus stop with this one guy every morning for 2 years, and I felt like he was my friend, she said. The first week of school, he would meet me at the end of his driveway with papers he had downloaded about how evil this was. One brother and sister put their hands on Paula's head on the school bus and prayed to turn her back into a boy. Paula came home and said, I didn't really mind, but does this mean they're not going to be my friends? Bettina went to see the mother of the praying kids. She's telling me, God doesn't make mistakes. I'm telling her, look, if God doesn't make mistakes, then your son doesn't have a vision problem and doesn't need glasses. Well, that's not the same thing. Why is it not the same thing? It's a body part. What's the difference? I just said, look, you're a really good mom, and I know in my heart of hearts, if you were in my shoes, you would do the same thing. You would listen to your child and make your child happy. Bettina works at the preschool where her children were enrolled, and she informed everybody there about the situation. She warned her boss that there would be a backlash. A month later, her boss told her, a parent questioned your ability to teach. I said, you cannot find a better teacher. What she does in her home life doesn't affect what she does at work. Your child is lucky to be in her class. Bettina would be willing to sit down with you and answer any questions. So I'm going to hang up. Why don't you write down your concerns and call me back? The parent never called back, and the parent's daughter remained enrolled. I first met Greg and Bettina at a trans conference in Philadelphia. Soon, a beautiful little girl came over with Greg's courtly parents, who presented the deceptive air of having attended trans conferences for decades. Paula shook my hand, a little somberly, then skipped down the hallway, her grandparents in pursuit. Bettina said, this conference is more for us than for her. She knows what she's doing. We're clueless. I asked whether they thought Paula's identity would, over time, be trans or simply female. Bettina said, Greg doesn't see her as transgender anymore. but that's partly because he doesn't give her a bath every day. Bettina and Greg showed me the safe folder they take with them at all times. Many parents of trans kids keep one. Paperwork to be shown in the event of trouble, as law enforcement and the medical system can be unfamiliar with or hostile to gender variance. A folder may include letters from the child's pediatrician and a psychotherapist confirming the child's gender identity, letters from at least three friends or family members, and, if possible, a pastor or minister or other prelate that testify to the parent's sound parenting skills, videos or snapshots of the child displaying atypical gender behaviors throughout life, copies of birth certificates, passports, and social security cards that reflect a change of gender or name, a home study documenting family stability, if available, and a Bureau of Criminal Information report that shows that the parents are not child abusers. I asked whether Bettina's advocacy perspective made it easier for her than for Greg, or the other way around. Greg began crying. "I just struggled," he sobbed, "because it was my little boy. I want my child to be happy, but I found the pictures of us as a family before all this, and I miss that little boy. Just once in a while, it still hurts." I asked Bettina whether she ever felt that way. "No," she said after a minute's thought. "What I regret is that time with Paula that I didn't have. I missed my daughter's infancy, spending all my energy on someone else who never existed." Many parents of trans kids described to me grieving for the child they had lost, even as they gained another. The mother of one trans man observed, "The same-sex parent experiences a certain kind of rejection, a rejection by one's child of membership in a tribe, that the opposite-sex parent doesn't." I met one father at a trans conference who said, "I accept it intellectually, but I still have emotional prejudice against my son." And even saying, "son," sticks in my throat. He had an autistic daughter and a deaf wife. Autistic and deaf were easy. No one blamed me. But this, people laugh at me. Why can't he just come to terms with his handicap privately? We all have handicaps and disabilities, and we learn how to live with them. This father's son said to me, "I knew from the time I was an infant that I had something to hide, and for a long time I didn't even know what it was. But I immediately knew who I was not, and then who I am is what was left." One father fought against using feminine pronouns for his trans daughter and ended up in counseling. Finally, our therapist asked, "Is it making him happy for you to insist on calling him a boy?" Of course, the answer was no. But when he asked me if it would make my son happy if I called him she, the answer was a clear yes. He then asked me what was more important to me than my child's happiness. I started to cry. My fear of ridicule, coupled with my fear of the ridicule he would suffer, was causing me to deny him true happiness. The Bettelheim-like notion that the child's gender-inappropriate behavior is symptomatic of the parent's gender transgressions determined treatment for most of the 20th century. In the 1940s and 50s, the psychologist John Money posited that gender is a learned set of behavior and attitudes. He believed that health required strong gender identification and favored giving girls every encouragement to be girlish, and boys every inducement to masculinity. Money's theory was explicitly tested on David Reimer, one of identical twins whose penis was burned off during a circumcision. Money proposed to Reimer's parents that they raise him as a girl, oversaw infant sex reassignment surgery, and instructed them to give him only girlish clothes and toys. The parents were told that they must never tell David what had happened. For years, Money published fraudulent articles about the great success of this experiment, thereby encouraging others to attempt similar therapies, which damaged thousands of people. Only in the late 1990s did David Reimer give an interview to Rolling Stone, which eventually grew into the book, As Nature Made Him, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Girl. Reimer's childhood was the antithesis of the one Money had portrayed, filled with rage and misery. He insisted on urinating standing up, and despised Money and the dolls and frilly dresses that were forced on him. His behavior at school became so violent that his parents finally broke down and told him the real story when he was 14. Reimer had penile reconstruction and lived as a man in later life, but the damage done was enormous, and he committed suicide at 38. Recent science suggests that successfully raising genetically programmed boys as girls is almost impossible. A study from Johns Hopkins looked at children born with cloacal extrophy, a condition in which they have XY, male, chromosomes and testes, but no penis, who were castrated and assigned female gender at birth. Many chose to live as boys or men as they grew up, and all had moderate to marked interests and attitudes that were considered typical of males. William G. Reiner, who authored the study, said, "These children demonstrate that normal male gender identity can develop not only in the absence of the penis, but even after the removal of testicles or castration at birth and unequivocal rearing as female. Their identity and gender role seem to have developed despite a total environment telling them that they were female." Kirk Murphy was treated for childhood effeminacy at UCLA in the 1970s, under the auspices of O. Ivar Lovaas, the theoretician who developed the reward and punishment behavioral treatments for autism, to which some autistic people have vigorously objected. Kirk's mother was coached through a one-way mirror to reward him for masculine behavior and to ignore feminine behavior. Though he became so upset during these sessions that he would scream, his mother was reassured that she was doing the right thing. At home, a token system much like that used with autistic children was put into play. He was given blue chips for masculine behaviors. A certain number of these meant he got a treat. He received red chips for feminine behaviors and was beaten by his father with a belt when he had too many of them. The effeminate behavior eventually ceased, and for years the work was written up as a success. The experimenters changed Kirk's name to Craig for their publications and made him an avatar for the pliability of behavior. George Reckers, the therapist who had worked directly with Kirk, became a founding member of the Family Research Council, a religious organization that lobbies against gay rights. He was ultimately revealed to be gay himself. Kirk joined the Air Force and lived as a masculine man, until he hanged himself in 2003 at 38. His mother and siblings went public in 2011 to talk about how the therapy had destroyed him. His sister said, "The research has a postscript that needs to be added. Kirk Andrew Murphy was Craig, and he was gay, and he committed suicide. I want people to remember that this was a little boy who deserved protection, respect, and unconditional love. I don't want him to be remembered as a science experiment." Phyllis Burke's Gender Shock, published in 1996, documented with considerable horror that many of the techniques that destroyed Kirk Murphy were still in use and still receiving government funding. Indeed, some are in use even as I write. Tony Ferriolo showed such pronounced masculinities all his life The doctors who examined him when he was still called Anne thought he must be intersex. When I met him, Tony was in his 40s. His father had not spoken to him in 5 years. His mother saw him occasionally and continued to call him Anne. "They're missing out on a really cool guy," Tony said to me. At 5, Anne and her twin, Michelle, were playing football with their brothers, Frank and Felix, and Anne took her shirt off. Her mother said, "Girls don't take their shirts off." Anne began to cry and said she was a boy. "She never played with dolls," Tony's mother, Big Anne, remembered. "She never wore a dress. She wouldn't carry a pocketbook. I surmised she was going to be a lesbian." 3 early behaviors are often taken as indicators of fixed identity. What underwear the child selects, what swimsuits the child prefers, and how the child urinates. "I remember trying to stand up and pee as a little kid," Tony said. "I never wore girl underwear or bathing suits. I didn't even know that people had intercourse, but I knew that my gender was male." When Anne was in 5th grade in a New Haven elementary school, the teacher asked what each pupil wanted to be when he or she grew up, and Anne said she wanted to be a boy. The class erupted in laughter. By 11, she was self-injurious. "You've got a little kid that's outside for recess, taking a piece of glass, cutting themselves," Tony said. "I'd gouge and gouge, then take dirt and try to get an infection to hurt myself as much as I could. My parents knew it. No one did anything." Anne's sister, Michelle, identified as a lesbian early on, but she was a jock, as popular as Anne was marginalized. Anne's father, Anthony, was abusive, and Big Anne, addicted to Valium, was passive in the face of that. Adolescence is a trauma for most trans people, and for Anne doubly so, as she had organic surges of both male and female hormones, despite showing no anatomical or genetic markers for intersex. "My facial hair and boobs are growing at the same time. What the hell's going on here?" By the time Anne was 13, she was shaving every day. "I took up drugs and drinking. I was suspended more than I was in school." From age 13, Anne was being sexually abused by a neighbor who was a good friend of her father's. The neighbor would call and ask Anne to help him with something. "If I didn't go, I got punished. If I went, I got raped." She finally told a neighbor what was happening, and the neighbor told her parents. 2 days later, my father had the guy over for a beer. "From that day on, I didn't trust anybody," Tony said. Her father often refused to speak to her. When she was 16, he threw her out of the house. She walked 15 miles into New Haven and moved in with a girlfriend. When that arrangement failed, she was homeless for a month. "Then I called my mother and asked to go back home," Tony recalled, hanging his head. "I went back into the bullshit." Through her 20s and 30s, Anne was a club promoter and threw huge parties for hundreds of lesbians. She started a band called Vertical Smile. But she never felt like a lesbian. She started using Tony, spelled T-O-N-I, in a concession to the family. "I used to pray to God that I was a butch lesbian," Tony said. "But a butch lesbian wants breasts and a vajayjay. A transgender person wants a penis." In his mid-30s, Tony was in a car accident and received an insurance settlement. His family suggested he buy a house. He spent the funds on a double mastectomy. Tony was not interested in bottom surgery. "That part of my body isn't public, so it was never an issue. The boobs were public. When the doctor unbandaged me, my knees just buckled. When I took my girlfriend Kirsten to the beach, I said, I'm experiencing everything for the first time. I haven't shaved since. I fucking love my goatee. When I look in the mirror, I see the person that was always supposed to be there. I used to take sleeping pills so I wouldn't have to live much of my life. Now all I want is to stay awake. When I saw Tony, he'd lost more than 60 pounds. You can't love your body if you hate your body. Now I eat healthy. I work out. Tony credits his therapist, Jim Collins, for much of his psychic transformation. I was an angry lesbian, he said. I didn't want to be an angry man. Tony's younger brother, Felix, said, My sister's my brother now, and I've never seen him happier in my life. Felix's kid switched naturally from Aunt Tony to Uncle Tony. Tony's father and his brother Frank were not supportive. Big Anne was distraught, and they did not meet for a full year after the surgery. Then she said, Well, I'll come over, Tony said. I thought, Is she going to open the door and pass out? So she came in and she was like, Oh my God, you look just like my dentist. After Tony's surgery, Michelle began calling herself Nick. At first I was pissed, Tony said. The first thing I do alone as a twin, he's got to stand on my fucking coattails. But I can see his sadness that he's not who I am yet. He still has breasts. He doesn't pass. People were like, You're sure he's not doing it because you did it? I said, I need to support him, no matter why he's doing it. When I asked Big Anne if she could see that Anne had become Tony, she said, Once in a while I say Tony, but mostly it just comes out Anne. Really, deep down, it's my daughter. When I look at him, I still see her. She turned to Tony. You always had that angry something that was bothering you inside, but I didn't know anything about this back then. I was stupid in a way. Tony put a hand on her arm. I don't think you were stupid, he said. Big Anne said, I watched things on television about it. I started understanding more. It's not that you wanted to be this way. She turned to me. Her being unnatural, I was upset by it at first, but I understood more how they felt inside. Now she does all this activism. That's very good. Big Anne turned back and forth. You're still my child, she said to Tony. I still love her, she said to me. You know what I mean. Him? I asked Tony whether he minded being called Anne and she. He said, Andrew, she thinks I'm a straight girl going through a phase, but I had to realize that my mother's my mother. My mother can call me them and it wouldn't bother me. What bothers me is that I still see her just 4 or 5 times a year. Big Anne's quiet acceptance of and palpable love for her child are in her mind subsidiary to the splintering of her family following Tony's transition. She responded to most of the questions I asked her about herself with information about her husband. Her effacement of Tony echoed her self-effacement. When I asked how she had felt about Anne's being gay, she said, My husband accepted her being a lesbian. She turned to Tony. He knows that you should have been a boy, but he still says, Why couldn't she just stay a lesbian like everybody else? Tony said to his mother, You have risen to the occasion. You come and see me. We talk. Big Anne sighed and turned to me. My husband went to his mother's sister, who's 90, and she started crying. She's still your child. You go see her. You'll get used to it. Then the priest said, Go see him. He's your son. Tell him that it bothers you, but talk to him. But he never did. When holidays come around, I'd like to have all my children with me, but he won't allow it. He worries that people will think he gave in. I was surprised that Big Anne had agreed to talk to me. Tony had told her to watch an Oprah special about trans kids. She called him and said, I'll meet with Andrew if you like. That was you. I'm sorry. I didn't know. Tony explained, Nobody fucking knew in the 70s. My mother's a nice lady. She has a good heart. But this is big. Her only two daughters weren't daughters. I asked Big Ann what her husband would say when she arrived home. He'll ask how she is, she said. He misses her. Tony's natural hormonal balance, whatever caused him to grow facial hair, has been sufficient, and he does not take testosterone. Like all trans people, Tony is often asked about his genitalia. He takes it as a question about his strap-ons. A lot of people ask, Do you have a penis? My answer is, I have five. I just go to the next question. Does your girlfriend know you're trans? I'm like, Love is honesty. I'm not ashamed of who I am. Tony described being at a Stop and Shop and seeing a woman he used to work with. She was, Oh my God, Annie? I said, Actually, it's Tony now. She grabs my hand and says, It is not God's fault that you're a freak. I just said, I've never been happier in my life. I knew that if I lost it, it would have been, Oh, look at the trans guy, what an asshole. If you have a positive interaction with me as a trans person, you're going to think twice about jeering at a trans woman or doing a hate crime. There's a purpose to everybody's life. That's mine. I want to start a non-profit to give two guys a year chest surgery. Screw Starbucks gift cards. You want to give somebody a present? Give them a chest. Give them a penis. A few months later, Tony started a foundation to do exactly that, and he named it after his beloved therapist, Jim Collins, who had died a few months earlier. He inspired me to be an activist, as I hope to inspire people behind me to be activists, and hopefully the people behind them won't have to be activists because it won't be a fucking issue, Tony said. When Big Ann had confessed during our conversation with Tony that she still worried everything was her fault, her son had responded, It's nobody's fault. But I have to tell you that if it was your fault, I would thank you, because my transition is the best thing that ever happened to me. Then Tony laughed. He said, Life isn't about finding yourself. Life is about creating yourself. Natal males who become females are often unconvincing as women when clothed because of their height and the thickness of their bones. However, their postoperative genitalia, sexual response, and urination patterns can be almost identical to those of genetic females. Natal females who transition can usually pass in public once they develop facial and body hair, deep voices, and in many instances male pattern baldness. But their sex organs are noticeably different from the genuine article. Most cannot urinate while standing up, and none can achieve a male orgasm. One preoperative trans woman I met said, These body parts are nice, but they're not mine, and it makes me feel better to know that I don't have to keep them going forever. A trans man to whom I repeated this replied, I'm like one of those IKEA sets of furniture that looks great until you realize you're missing a few parts. It takes little injected testosterone to overwhelm a genetic female's estrogen, about the same amount that would be administered to a male whose body was not producing the hormone. To overwhelm a genetic male's testosterone is a bigger project. A female whose body is not producing estrogen requires 1 to 2 milligrams of estradiol per week to remain premenopausal. A genetic male requires 28 to 56 milligrams of estradiol per week to feminize the body. Many endocrinologists recommend that genetic males undergo gonadectomy as early as possible, because such high levels of estradiol create health risks. After gonadectomy, estradiol is effective in much smaller doses. Most professionals working with trans people follow the Harry Benjamin standards, which required that the patient live in his or her preferred gender for at least a year and complete a full year of psychotherapy prior to surgery or hormone treatment, and that two clinicians, one a doctor, recommend medical procedures. These safeguards are intended to weed out people at risk of postoperative regret, though many complain that they eat up time when a despairing person could be achieving happiness through a speedy transition. They also protect healthcare providers from liability. For natal males being affirmed as female, procedures may include not only castration and vaginoplasty, but also electrolysis, which can take up to 5,000 hours and cost over $100,000, feminizing facial surgeries to reduce the forehead, chin, and jaw, a nose job, a tracheal shave to reduce the Adam's apple, breast augmentation, hair transplants to conceal baldness, and tightening of the vocal cords. The construction of a vagina is most often achieved through penile inversion. After a space is cleared between the rectum and the urethra, the inverted skin of the penis is used to line the vagina, sometimes supplemented by skin grafted from the stomach, buttocks, or thigh. A second method, rectal sigmoid transfer, uses a segment of the large intestine to create a vaginal lining, which provides natural lubrication and unlimited vaginal depth. The procedure is more invasive, more costly, and can lead to mucus leaking into the vagina. In both methods, the scrotal skin is used to create the labia, and part of the glands to create a clitoris. Natal women being affirmed as male may remove breasts, double mastectomy, uterus, hysterectomy, ovaries, oophorectomy, fallopian tubes, self-injectomy, and vagina, vaginectomy. Because regular gynecological exams are anathema to most trans men. Surgically constructed penises are expensive and often unsatisfactory, so many trans men opt not to have them. But for those who do, there are two primary methods. In a genitoplasty, the surgeon wraps the skin around the hormonally enlarged clitoris to form a penis about the size of a thumb. It maintains orgasmic capability, but is not generally large enough for intercourse. In a phalloplasty, a tube of skin is raised up out of the groin or mid-abdomen and attached to the pubis. It looks a little bit like a suitcase handle. Secondary procedures augment the blood supply to this flap, and it is cut free after 2 to 4 months and sculpted to resemble a phallus. It lacks sexual feeling, but implanted silicone rods or a manual pump can allow an erection. In the most complicated procedure, running at least $100,000, flesh from the forearm with the blood vessels and nerves that supply it is fashioned into the shape of a penis, and then, using microsurgery, the blood vessels and nerves are attached to those in the pubis. Such a penis appears most natural and has sensation. In any procedure, a scrotum is constructed by sewing the labia majora together. Urethroplasty, urethral extension to the end of the newly made glands, is a further surgical undertaking. "Think what a complicated organ it is," Norman Spack said. "It's amazing it works at all, and the human species depends on it." Prepubescent transgender children with supportive families may avoid some physical difficulties of transition through the use of hormone blockers, which suppress puberty. This therapy may start as early as age 10 for girls and 12 for boys. Lupron, the most common of these GnRH inhibitors, was developed 30 years ago as an alternative to surgical castration in the treatment of androgen-dependent tumors. Because it is associated with decreases in bone mineral density and compromised memory, it requires careful monitoring. The treatment effectively buys families time, If the child is indeed transgender, puberty blockers can save him or her from going through the wrong puberty, and may obviate many surgeries in later life. Girls administered Lupron do not develop breasts, widened hips, female fat distribution, or active ovaries. The estrogen surge that limits female height does not occur for them, so they grow tall. Boys administered Lupron do not develop facial or body hair. Their voice does not deepen, and their Adam's apple doesn't grow. Bones do not thicken, shoulders broaden, or hands and feet enlarge. Estrogen supplementation, which closes the growth plates, can be timed to limit their height. The essential androgyny of childhood can be prolonged. If someone goes off Lupron without starting cross-sex hormones, the deferred puberty of his or her natal sex will begin within a few months and will follow its natural course. Cross-sex hormones will initiate the puberty of the person's affirmed gender. None of the children in the original Dutch protocol to study this practice has chosen to revert to natal gender, and most have stayed on GnRH inhibitors until they obtained gender reassignment surgery between 18 and 21. Lupron delays certain events, but it is also an event itself, heralding a profound transformation. There is concern that starting children on blockers will cause some who are just going through a phase to make it permanent. They may be too embarrassed, scared, or confused to revert if they think that they've made a mistake. In Britain, where reassignment surgery is covered by the National Health Service, particularly conservative policies on hormone blockers prevail. The Gender Identity Development Service at the Tavistock Clinic requires patients to progress through most of their natural puberty before allowing them to transition. Domenico De Segli, the team's child and adolescent psychiatrist, reports that 20% of adolescents treated at his clinic choose to forego medical intervention after completion of puberty. The underlying modernist fallacy here is that doing nothing is not doing something, that slowing transition is cautious and accelerating it is rash. Rushing a child into a transition in which he will psychically or medically be trapped for the rest of his life would be a terrible mistake. However, forcing a child who is firm about his own identity to develop a body that will never match who he knows himself to be, even after multiple expensive traumatic surgeries, is equally troubling. The Tavistock model of prudence contains marked cruelty. In the United States, these are family problems rather than national policy. Parents say, "I'm not ready to deal with this yet," Stephanie Brill said. But they are dealing with it. Badly. Spack said, "Those who oppose puberty blockers complain of the young age at which we make this intervention. I would argue that puberty itself is the most noxious intervention possible." Use of Lupron for gender dysphoria is seldom covered by American insurance plans, and its prohibitive cost creates a class divide between transgender youth whose parents are willing and can afford it, and all others. Likewise, there is a generation gap. At trans conferences I attended, older people would weep openly when they met children who would never have to walk this earth as their genetic sex, as one put it. Shannon Minter, civil rights attorney, legal director for the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and himself a trans man who did not have the benefit of Lupron, spoke of these young people as a kind of superclass. What did transgender people experience in the past, when they could not alter their bodies to harmonize with their identity? What will transgender people experience in the future, when surgery becomes more refined? These questions are both technical and teleological. Minter acknowledged the idea that in order for a child to express his or her authentic identity, There has to be a dramatic physiological intervention, challenges our most foundational ideas about authenticity and self-identity. It can feel like a technological madness. One has to wonder whether it is more of a technological madness than the cochlear implant. Many people outside these horizontal identities class that intervention as a way to normalize an abnormality, and this as a way to indulge one. It is instructive to note, however, that whereas the protest against cochlear implants comes from the marginal identity group, the demand for trans surgeries comes from the marginal identity group. Jennifer Finney Boylan has written two books that deal with her gender switch and has held forth about gender identity on All My Children and Oprah. When I asked whether she hoped to be perceived as female or as transgender, she said, "On a national stage in front of 20 million people, I'm happy to be trans. On a day-to-day basis, when I go into a store, restaurant, or gas station, I want to be read as a woman. I refer to myself as female, knowing that female includes Britney Spears and Barbara Bush. Look at Julia Child. I'm certainly as feminine as Julia Child." I visited Jenny, then 49, in her mother's house on the Philadelphia Main Line. Her old room looked like a boy's room, banged-up furnishings, rock and roll posters on the walls. She showed me an adjoining storage room. "Back in the day, there were girls' clothes in here, my mother's, my sister's," Jenny said. "I could grab whatever was on the back of that door." Jim Boylan always knew that he was female, but he also knew that his transition would be painful for others. "So I thought, if I can make the guy thing work, let's go for that," Jenny said. It took until I was almost 40 before I saw that I'd gone as far as I could, 44 before I had surgery. Rather than wishing I'd gone through transition earlier, if it's about wishing, I wish that I'd been born female. Here I am, a grown woman, but I have a boyhood. If I ever feel lost or melancholy, it's because I can't see my life as a whole. I can't figure out how I got here from there. Becoming Jenny entailed a truckload of surgeries. Vaginoplasty, a procedure in which her face was peeled down so her skull at the brow level could be shaved to give her a more plausibly female look. A reduction of her Adam's apple. "The surgery turns out to be easy," she said. "Nothing is cut off. The neovagina looks like it's supposed to and does what it's supposed to. The plumbing works and so does the electricity. I've been to doctors who didn't know and couldn't tell." Jim Boylan was married, and his wife, Dee Dee, chose to stay in the marriage, though she once said to Jenny, "Every success you have as a woman is a failure for me." They have two children together, fathered when Jenny was still a man. "Dee Dee is a straight woman who's the center of my life, and yet she's not attracted to me," Jenny said. "Everyone always says Dee Dee is this great saint. Does it betray a complete lack of humility to say that she's lucky to be married to me because I'm a nice person, and I love her, and I'm a good parent to our children? All kinds of things happen to families. Children get cancer. Parents have car accidents. Families have to move to Texas. This has involved some heartbreak, but life does that anyway." At 6 and 8, Jenny's two sons decided that they couldn't really call her Daddy anymore. They already had a mommy, so they announced that they were going to call her Maddie. When Jenny last did Oprah, her older son wrote a letter that was read on the show. It said in part, "Sometimes it's true that I wish I had a regular father. Most of the time, though, I feel like I am the luckiest kid on earth. I cannot think of a way in which life could be better." Transition is a change of identity for the person who goes through it, and also for all the people who surround that person. I'm glad for my story to be a public narrative where things worked out, Jenny says. You know, boy meets girl, boy is girl, girl meets girl, girl stays with girl, that age-old tale. The biggest change for me is not going from male to female. It's going from someone who has a secret to someone who doesn't really have secrets anymore. It's unimaginably difficult to know that other people consider your fondest of dreams and greatest of sorrows A, incomprehensible, and B, hilarious. A double life is exhausting and ultimately tragic because you can't ever be loved if you can never be known. People often question a trans person's authenticity in his or her affirmed gender. I call myself a gender immigrant, Jenny said. I'm a citizen of this land of women, but it is true that I was born somewhere else. I came here, and I got naturalized. Jenny laughed slyly, or unnaturalized, as the case may be. In the summer of 2000, Jenny decided to tell her mother, who was then 84 years old. I thought Mom was going to be resilient, Jenny said. But resilient means that someone snaps back after a blow, and I was aware that it was going to be a blow. She was bewildered, so I started to explain it, and I began to cry. I met Hildegard Boylan when she was 91, and as we all sat together, she said to Jenny, "You waited until 5 o'clock when we were having a gin and tonic. Then you just said, 'I always wanted to be a girl, and I didn't know how to tell you because I didn't think you'd love me anymore.' Then I broke down and said, 'I'll always love you.'" Hildegard experienced considerable difficulty at the beginning. "He'd led a perfectly normal life," she assured me. Jenny protested. "I was never perfectly normal." Hildegard laughed. "I was a Cub Scout leader, and he was a Cub Scout." It took Hildegard some time to be ready to tell her friends, but about a year after that conversation, she had a party to introduce her daughter. She turned to Jenny. "You were surprised when all of your close friends accepted it so readily. So I thought it worth trying my friends. I hadn't even heard the word transgender, so I just went with Jenny. It's impossible to hate anyone whose story you know." Hildegard leaned forward as if to tell me a great confidence, and said the only thing she could never accept was Jenny's shoulder-length blonde hair. Turning to Jenny, she said, "If I tell you this, you'll cut your hair tonight when you go to bed. Ann Coulter has your hair." Jenny said indignantly, "So does Laura Dern, and she's a movie star." Jenny had come out to her sister, who was living in England, 6 months after telling her mother. "She was the last major important figure in my life that I came out to," Jenny said. "I mailed her this lengthy letter, and she wrote back basically, 'I don't want to get to know this Jennifer.' A year later, I got a letter from her daughter Eliza, who's 10, saying, 'I don't understand this. I'm scared of this.' I wrote her back, 'I'm sorry you're scared. I know it's confusing. My love for you hasn't changed, and I hope in time you'll get used to me.' My sister called a week later, furious. 'How dare I write her daughter a letter like that?' Finally, she said, 'What we would like is to be left alone.' I said, 'I'll always love you.' That was 7 years ago now. I remember thinking, well, now it's going to be as hard for Cindy as it used to be for me. She and all the people I loved would have to go through years of learning how to talk about this. That fear I carried all those years, the shame, the secrecy, the inability to tell someone else, is what I gave to my mother and sister." In her gym days, Jenny had hoped that she could fall in love with a woman and learn to be happy being a man. "We are who we are as a result of who we love," Jenny said. She smiled her bright smile. I'd always prayed for love to save me. And in a weird way, it was love that saved me, although not in the way I expected. The love of Dee Dee